That old gang kindly whispers, just fall in line and smile. Mean mama haunts me, and I crave the peace of mind. I don't know where I'm going, I'm feeling kind of queer. I've been from several places, and I'm going to be from there.
When Jimmy Rogers died in 1933, he was just 35 years old, and yet the man who was called the singing brakeman, the blue yodeler, and then the father of country music had an influence on a wide range of artists like Muddy Waters, Woody Guthrie, Dolly Parton, and Beck. In Meeting Jimmy Rogers, Barry Mazur explores the life and enduring legacy of the former railroad worker who was born James Charles Rogers. His book has been published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased that he has journeyed from Nashville, Tennessee, to be here with me today. Hello.
Man, hi. Great to be here.
Now, we talked about a man who has been called the father of country music, but listening to that, that was a bluesy, jazzy performance, wasn't it?
Jimmy Rogers wouldn't have known that he was in country music. The word didn't even exist. If in his own day, if you'd asked, you know, what does this guy do for a living, probably people would most likely have said, he's that vaudevillian who sings a lot of blues. The country thing emerged over time, and there's good reasons for it, but it wasn't obvious at first.
He set the style to some degree. We'll get into all of that in a while, but you start off your book saying that you're dealing with a mystery when you're writing about Jimmy Rogers. What did you mean?
Yes. There were plenty of people around in his day, but here we have one who, over 75 years later, all the records are in print. On any given month, somebody's recording the songs again. This is true in all sorts of genres, not just in country music, but in blues, in rock, in folk, cross the line, cowboy music, name it, pop. And all over the world is the reach. And I wanted to look at how did that happen, and that's the how in that title.
Well, how much did you know about him when you started working on the project?
Well, I've been listening to him a long time, to begin with, like close to 40 years. And there's an excellent biography that was out 30 years ago and is still standard, which is one of the reasons I decided that the way to get at this question was not going to be another biography, but a quite different kind of book that would look at the life story of the music and not at the man.
And do you think you solved the mystery?
I think I begin to get at it. I think people who have read it feel that way. It's in that subtitle, which is that the power of the man wasn't only in this set of songs, and it's a famous set of songs. You'll hear Mule Skinner Blues or Any Old Time or Tea for Texas, you know, over and over in the jailhouse now. But it's not just that. It has to do with the way he carried himself, the kind of career space that he worked at as this guy who came from nowhere, from down home, who made it, who was one of us for the people he sang for, and you knew it.
Was he really a railroad brakeman?
Yes. Oh, yes. From childhood, he wanted to be in show business, but he came from a railroading family, and a lot of musicians will be able to empathize with the fact that his dad told him he pretty well had to have a trade, so he got into the railroad business. But he'd always wanted to be a singer.
But I suspect the being on the railroad, which allowed him to travel around, influenced his musical tastes.
Oh, certainly. It certainly did. I mean, first of all, the most obvious thing is there's a lot of railroading songs associated with Jimmy. They were around before him, but they certainly got attached to him because he was a man who really worked that way, really knew it. He also, in that life, met additional musicians who were out there playing. He would so-called hobo, which meant riding a train to a next job. And he had a lot of encounters with musicians out on the road, and it changed the music he made.
How did he learn to play guitar?
Well, we're not certain. He told relatives that as far as the guitar went, he picked up a lot of very distinctive, idiosyncratic kind of guitar moves that people, I'm glad you asked, because people don't even ask about that often. But some of those he actually picked up from African-American hobos out on the trains, blues players. But he hadn't even played the guitar very long before he started recording. His instrument had been the mandolin and the banjo, vaudeville-style versions of those, but those were his thing.
And he was in vaudeville and did all sorts of different things in show business before his big success, his big breakthrough.
Yeah, absolutely. He wasn't getting very far, but when it came large, it came fast. I mean, once Tea for Texas was recorded, which was only about this third recording,
he was already almost 30 at the time, wasn't he?
Oh, yes.
He only had a short career because he... He died at 35, so he maybe had 6 years of fame.
The entire 112 some cuts that he recorded happened in about 5.5 years, which is a measure of how intense that was. That's Beatles or Rolling Stones at their peak. That's like 10 albums in 5 years kind of thing. So it was very fast. And the entire time, he already knew he was dying of tuberculosis from even before he started recording. So it's a story.
But he did record for one of the major labels, Victor. Was it a big label at the time?
Oh, yes. It was one of the biggest. That meant different things even within those 5 years because, I mean, he's starting in the roaring 20s and records are really selling. T for Texas sold, by most accounts, close to 1 million. This was kind of an Elvis sort of breakout. But by the time that he died in 1933, we're in the beginnings of the Depression. And a person was lucky to sell 5,000 records, which is about what he did.
Now, how did he contract tuberculosis? How old was he?
Well, he was diagnosed with it in 1924, so he was about 27 years old. I mean, you can never be exactly sure. It's an infectious situation. He'd been out there. He'd had some respiratory problems in his life. He'd been out on boxcars in the road, and he was diagnosed as a serious case of it. It was a very common disease, and the fact that he shared it with so many people was one of the ways that they related to him.
He was probably also breathing in a lot of coal dust.
No doubt. He reached a point where he couldn't do the train work anymore, and he really had to focus on the singing because the other was impossible.
Now, when he had those breakthrough recordings, the famous Bristol sessions with producer Ralph Peer, were they like anything that had been done before? The Carter family started around the same time, didn't they?
They were at the same session, but the music couldn't be more of a contrast with each other. Jimmy was the first one to bring modern narrative kind of singing, the kind of stuff we associate with Bing Crosby and others, to that kind of market, if you will, to that audience. The early hillbilly singers had been singing the rhythm of the line like it's written. Jimmy sings the sense of the lyric. And you can't listen to a Jimmy Rogers record and feel that you're in a modern era in the way the Carters are kind of still on the porch.
And some of his collaborators are surprising, but not when you think of the breadth of his music. He recorded with Louis Armstrong, didn't
he? Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did. One of those famous blue yodels, which wound up having numbers, and when they were sold, there were so many of them, which, you know, they were blues with yodels. And yes, famously, he recorded Blue Number 9 with Louis, who was a friend of his. It was not an unusual kind of acquaintance for him, but it was very unusual to have racially integrated records in 1930.
Who else did he collaborate with?
Oh, the vast numbers of people. Like his songwritings were in collaboration. Some of the people who became top musicians in Western Swing later on his records, Hawaiian guitarists are on his records. Some outright blues singers and jug bands are on his records. It's a wide variety.
And his influence is extraordinary. You mentioned the Blue Yodels. They covered a wide swath as well. I remember hearing that R.H. Harris, who's one of the most important of the gospel quartet leads, he grew up listening in Texas to Jimmy Rogers, and he had that kind of a yodel that later Sam Cooke adapted when he took over as the soul stirrer's lead.
There you go. That's the kind of thing that we follow in this book. I mean, I interview over 80 musicians from all these different fields, and it was necessary to track all these different lines into blues, into rock, into country, into folk, just to follow it. And you find musicians like this. I mean, Howlin' Wolf said, you know, interviewers ask him, and they expect to hear, this is a guy who learned guitar from Charlie Patton, that this is my hero, and he tells them it's Jimmy Rogers. I turned that yodel into a howl.
I would have thought it was be Robert Johnson, because that's how Muddy Waters
so.
Was discovered, right?
In fact, Robert Johnson sang Jimmy Rogers songs on street corners.
Barry Mazur's book is called Meeting Jimmy Rogers, How America's Original Roots Music Hero Changed the Pop Sounds of a Century. It's published by Oxford University Press. He made a movie, a musical short, and he toured both as a solo act and in a variety show. Is that when he started wearing the various costumes that also had a real influence?
Well, he was aware of this. And yes, I think you hit on something very important. He'd got to make this movie. We're talking very early days of talkies, like 1929. You know, we're just past the jazz singer. And he was asked to do this. It gives you a sense of his stardom. But yes, one of the modern things about him that's really stuck, that follows with this idea of him as an expansive roots music hero is that he adopted, and could live with these series of images. So he looks like a trainman one day. He's suddenly a rounder in a bowler hat. Then he's a cowboy. And these things, these images would shift from year to year. And we're very used to that now if it's David Bowie, but you don't think of... But this is where it starts.
But those cowboy outfits... probably influenced every country singer to follow because they all started wearing those 10-gallon hats and the cowboy shirts.
There's a chapter in the book called Easterner in a Cowboy Hat because this was a guy from Mississippi. I mean, he had very little to do with all of that. He moved out to Texas, in fact, but we're used to that now.
But most country singers came from the South and yet wore cowboy outfits.
I'm right with you. That's right.
Sound performance that he made, the film, is available in a Shanachie DVD.
Yes, that's right. That's right. You can see it. And
it's
you
called
can...
Things Ain't Like They Used to Be.
That's what the DVD's called. The movie was just called The Singing Brakeman in its day, but it's on that DVD, yes.
Do you think that if he had lived longer, that like Ernest Tubb or Hank Snow or somebody, that the myth, that the legend would be as strong as it is?
Well, this was one adaptable individual. I don't know about the myth, but I have very little doubt that he would have found ways to adjust into the new situation into the mid-30s to record. He was clearly doing things that sound exactly like, for instance, the arrangements used in cowboy movies just a few years later, and Gene Autry was, you know, one of the advocates for him. So it's really not difficult at all to imagine Jimmy moving into cowboy movies as an actor and singing that way, or another proposition, which was to come here to New York City and go on the radio.
But he also came to New York City and died under rather tragic circumstances.
He did. His very last recording session was going on, and he was staying at the Taft Hotel. And coming off a cot, he did his last recordings, and he went back to the hotel that night and died in the arms of one of the executives from Pure Records.
He was spitting up blood while he was singing.
Yeah, it's tuberculosis can be a pretty ugly outcome for life. You know.
How popular was he when he died?
You know, there are people who debate this. It's tougher to tell in 1933 because the record industry was so struck by the Depression that the sales were down. But he was doing as well as people did. We don't get a sense that he was considered old hat or gone out of fashion or anything like that. But if he had lived a few more years, it'd be easier to answer that question. What there's no doubt is that he left behind advocates who wanted to do that music, who took it in so many directions, and it kept on living.
Although the yodels are gone, aren't they?
Well, they are and they aren't. You know, it's certainly not date bait today, but it seemed like hot stuff then. It was a pretty intimate thing to do in a microphone. But you know, it wandered through cowboy music. It came forward. We still hear hiccups in country singers and rock and rollers, and there's a history to it.
Well, we're going to go out with Blue Yodel number 9. But my great thanks to you, Barry Mazur, who has been writing about American music since the 1970s. It was a longtime senior editor for the Roots and Pop Music magazine and website No Depression, writes frequently on country and pop music for the Wall Street Journal, and his book is called Meeting Jimmy Rogers, How America's Original Roots Music Hero Changed the Pop Sounds of a Century. It's published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much.
My pleasure to be here.
And here's Jimmy.
Standing on the corner, I didn't mean no harm. Along come a police, he took me by the arm. It was down in Memphis, corner of Beale and Main. He says, big boy, you'll have to tell me your name. Do you believe?